heard it said, it doesn't have to be fun to be fun. With that in mind, join us for an insider's glimpse into all things trekking, safaris, and world adventure. From packing for your Everest base camp trek, to what it felt like for a cancer patient to attempt to summit Kilimanjaro, or visiting a village in the Sacred Valley of Peru. You will be inspired, informed, and ignited to get out there and start adventuring.
Welcome, 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 everybody, to the Type 2 Fun podcast. My name is Mariah, and I'm pretty sure I say this every podcast, but I definitely mean it this time. You're going to absolutely love this conversation. I'm talking today to Mr. Jay Irwin, and I was telling him before that our pre-recording conversation could have been its own podcast. I hate that I didn't hit record. But so who knows what's going to come out of this one. I'm so excited. Jay, how are you?
I am doing fantastic.
We are so happy to have you here. And, you know, the laundry list of things that we could discuss, I think it's just pretty amazing testament to your life that I had to pick and choose between, do I talk about this amazing feat or this amazing feat? So, you know, I might start it with what don't you do?
You know, do you, I don't play golf.
You don't play golf.
I did as a younger child, and no, I have fully given it up.
Okay. All right. See, you are human. Now I believe it. That's real. So before we jump into the larger than life stuff, I'd love to just take us back down and ground us in planet Earth and tell me, you know, where do you live? What do you do in what I call the real world? And let's start with there to confirm with everybody that you are in fact human, because they're not going to believe it once we tell some of these stories.
Well, so from where I live, I am sitting in Frisco, Colorado, in the Summit County area near Breckenridge. And I am currently looking up at peak one of the 10-mile traverse. And that is my view from my kitchen window. And wow. Yeah, so that is, you know, a beautiful and inspiring view. And then as I was talking earlier, yesterday, we did the 10-mile traverse, which is hiking from my kitchen up to the top of peak one, all the way to peak 10 and back down. It's 19 miles and 8,000 vertical feet. And I was looking to have a little type 2 fun, and it just turned out to be type 1 fun. It was just a phenomenal experience. And my friend brought 13 snacks, a snack for each peak, and a couple of the half peaks.
Okay, so what was the best snack? I'm dying to know.
Oh, man. Well, I did make a phenomenal banana walnut bread that we saved until peak 9, and that was really a great one. But there was also this chocolate peanut butter brownie that I think gave me immediate diabetes. So I'm working today on lowering my blood sugar.
Well, I think maybe, you know, they do say to lower your glucose spike to walk after you eat. I think maybe you handled that with the rest of the traversing that you had to do. So, I mean, I feel like you're good.
Yeah, that might have done it. And then regarding your question, I often say I am currently in my third retirement. So I worked for 23 years in the enterprise software field, traveling around the world and talking to people about technology. I also was a programmer for a while. I did the technical side of sales and eventually ran the industry for the construction and real estate industry for the largest enterprise software company in the world. And it was a phenomenal experience. I have made amazing friendships along the way and got to travel and see the world. But at age 47, they shut down my department that I had founded, and they offered me an early retirement, which I ended up going up into the mountains and spent 7 days hiking from the top of the Mount Zirkle Wilderness to the bottom. And I decided, if not now, then when?
Yeah.
And why not take this early retirement of my life. But I realized I was much too young at that point to fully retire. So I took 20 months of retirement and enjoyed myself, traveled the world, spent time with my son on a 30-day ski race around the world. I took my daughter on a motorcycle trip to Yellowstone and Omaha and all sorts of fun places, did a bunch of rafting trips and hiking and enjoyed myself. And then I realized, why can't I take this and make this my job? And so I bought a company that had the permits and the guides and the certifications to allow me to take executives and employees from companies out and train them on teamwork and leadership in the outdoors.
Wow. And
so I did that for 7 years, and I absolutely loved doing that job, with the minor exception that I'm not sure it actually increased my net worth. In fact, it decreased it by quite a bit. and in addition, sometimes that will spoil your enjoyment of the things that you like to do.
Yeah.
So I'll say I loved to raft, and I used to raft all the time. I've rafted the Grand Canyon and the Middle Fork of the Salmon and various other rivers. But as soon as I turned that into what my job was, I lost the love of it.
Yeah.
So very difficult there. COVID comes along and basically shuts down that business. Right. And at that point, I decided I had, you know, done all of these events that I really enjoyed, but it was time for a change. So I took my second retirement. I stepped back into software for a year to see if I could do it again and realized that I couldn't. So I am currently in that third retirement, and I don't know. We'll see what the rest of the life brings. I still have a third left of my life, so I might as well make that count.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the retirement's not for you, but coming in and out brings new adventures. So maybe that's your thing. You just go in and out of retirement to find a new adventure.
I have been referred to it as retirement in installments. So do it while you're still healthy enough to do it.
Right.
And then come back and grab something that, you know, may fulfill your purpose or may fulfill your purpose for a time.
I love it. I think that that sounds amazing. And definitely you have lived many, many a life, which literally and figuratively, so we will get into that soon. And like I was telling you before we hit record, I mean, I want to jump right into what sounds like the gnarliest of stories. You were in an avalanche. I want to mute myself, and I just want to hear this story. What is it like? What happened? Where was it? What did you feel? I mean, I can't even imagine. And you came out on the other side. So I'm guessing that was definitely type 3 fun, meaning not fun at all.
Yeah. Definitely type 3 fun. And a major change point in my life. So if we take a look at leading up to it, you know, I was skiing more and more every year. My kids were getting older, so it provided either the ability to ski with them or the ability to take some longer time to, you know, go off and, you know, get the bigger ski trips together. So, you know, as I talk about it, I was basically on a 14-day ski bender where I had been skiing straight for 14 days and it was snowing like crazy and the snow was absolutely amazing. And so my buddy Bill calls up and says, "Hey, I'm thinking about going to chase a few storms. You up for coming with me?" And of course, the answer was absolutely. I had some time in my schedule to get out with him and, you know, go and chase these storms. So we got in his camper and went off and just hit a big powder day at Beaver Creek and a big powder day at Vail, and then started heading south, and Silverton had just gotten pounded with snow. So we went down there and skied at Silverton. And then we got the call from our other friend, Mike, who said, I just finished skiing Vail Pass. It's the best I've ever skied it. There's 3 feet of snow out there. You've got to come back and hit it. Wow. So we did. We drove from Silverton back to Vail Pass, and we took our 2 snowmobiles and drove them 6 miles into the backcountry. And wow. Our friends who were supposed to be there with us were ski patrol from Loveland, and they had been out skiing all morning and quite honestly, on our way in, which was later on in the day because we had driven back from Silverton, you know, it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They're like, listen, we have skied ourselves out. We're exhausted and we're heading back. And so it was just Bill and myself out there. And what any smart backcountry skier would do is you would always stay together. And you would, you know, make sure that you've got eyes on the other person. This is where I fall off my high horse and my ego and say, we did the opposite of that. And we made 3 really, really, really bad decisions. So the first was, we decided that since we had skied there so many times and we knew it so well, let's just do what we call hot laps. And that is, Bill will take the snowmobile down to the bottom and I will ski a run, and then we will switch. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, played rock, paper, scissors. I, quote, won, and I got to go first. And so I took off heading down the run that I knew was not a avalanche run. It was protected. It didn't have all the features of any avalanche danger. And I had skied it hundreds of times. I knew exactly where I was going. But as I headed to it, the snow was just so deep, coming over my head on every turn. And I made a wrong turn. And I don't know how I did it, but I got off into this new untracked area. And instead of thinking, huh, I should not go there, I should go to where I know, I went, this is amazing, and I'm invincible.
Oh, geez.
And as I skied down through this area and jumping cliffs and having the snow come up over your head, I got more and more of this hubris where I felt like I could do no wrong. And as I rolled up over this one roller in the snow and looked down a steep chute, the back of my mind said, don't do it. This is the perfect avalanche chute. It has all the things. It's wind loaded. It's a roller. It's 37 degree pitch. Do not go down this. But in my mind, I thought, if the avalanche goes, I'll be able to ski to the left into the trees to avoid it, or to the right into that open area and outrun it. That's not true. If you take a look at the Warren Miller films or the Teton Gravity Research films where they show these young kids getting caught in avalanches and skiing out of them, that's great for if you're a professional skier. I am nothing of the sort. But I made 3 of the most beautiful turns of my life, and I was on top of the world feeling like, this is amazing. I can't wait to tell Bill about this space. We'll have to ski it together. And then the entire mountain collapsed. And I felt everything drop and everything stopped. And I looked around, and the shattering of the avalanche just surrounded me. And I continue to tell people, it's like you're in Class 5 whitewater, and it's the avalanche just does with you what it wants to do.
It wants to do.
And so I got ripped through the trees. I hit the first tree, it knocked my skis off. I hit the second tree, it broke my leg and severed my nerves and arteries. And I hit the third tree and it shattered my pelvis. And when I came to the rest at the bottom of the avalanche chute, everything stopped and everything changed. And the things that were important were no longer this amazing skiing. Yeah. The things that were important were the people in your life and the people that you loved. And I thought about my kids.
Like engulfed by it to where you couldn't breathe, you know, or were you? Did you have to like find a way above it to gasp for air or?
So the lucky part was that the tree that broke my pelvis was also the tree that I was still riding at the end where it all stopped. And I was kept enough above the surface to where the snow came up to my chest.
Yeah.
And I was able to dig myself out.
Wow.
So I dug myself out and I stood up and I looked up the avalanche chute to see if any other avalanches were coming down. And I walked out of the avalanche chute
with a broken pelvis.
Now, I will tell you that when I made it to the hospital 8 hours later, the doctor said, no, you did not walk. There is no way with these injuries that you walked. But I remember walking. And I remember digging a snow cave to spend the night. And I guess that's adrenaline or, you know, whatever it might be, but it allowed me to do that with a broken pelvis and a snapped leg.
And so you spent the night on the mountain? How did you get found all that?
So I, you know, with me, and people always ask, did you have a beacon? Of course I had a beacon. But without Bill being there, he's not going to find me. Yeah. He was too far away to find me. But I was prepared with literally everything that I needed in my backpack. So I had a radio, and I pulled out the radio and I called Bill. And I got out just enough words to tell him I'd been caught in an avalanche, I was injured, and I needed help. And then the radio died because the batteries were really cold. So I pulled out an emergency blanket, I put it around myself, I pulled out hand warmers, I wrapped them around the radio, I stuck it inside my chest to warm both my chest up and the radio. I pulled out my shovel, I pulled out my duct tape and my avalanche probes. I took the avalanche probes, put them down my leg. I duct taped all that up and was able to make a makeshift cast for my leg. I had plenty of food and water. I had the ability to build a fire, although I wasn't thinking about it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I definitely was thinking about it at 6 o'clock in the evening. But I finally got the radio to work long enough to talk to Bill. And I told him, Bill, I'm going to try and find my skis. And then I'm going to ski out of there. And he said, really, with a broken leg, you're going to try and ski out of there? And he said, listen, I think I need to call search and rescue. And I'll call our buddies from Loveland Ski Patrol. And we'll get them in there to rescue you. And after some time talking back and forth, we decided that that was the best move. So he rode the snowmobile back up to the top of the peak. He called in the cavalry. They found me 3 hours later. Bill led the search and rescue team down to me. And by the time that they got to me, I was hypothermic. I had bled out on my leg. But they were able to keep that taped up and in the snow to basically freeze it to keep it from bleeding out. Bill built a fire. He gave me his jacket and he laid on top of me to keep me warm. And I remember saying to him, Bill, if you ever need anything, anything at all, and we get out of this alive, you just ask me. I owe you my life.
And he took you up on it, didn't he?
So 8 hours later, they got me out, got me to the ambulance. You know, I'm down at Stedman Hawkins or Vail Hospital with cold steel and bright lights. Four surgeries, 7 days later, they have at least cut me up and patched me up, and I'm going to be okay with no feeling in my left leg, but they were able to save it, which was nice. Wow. Yep. Yeah.
I'm riveted by this story. And what I think is honestly the best piece of it is what sounds like tremendous self-reflection on your part and a little bit of a internal conversation with your ego.
It was a big changing point in my life on that, where I no longer felt that I was invincible and couldn't die. I will also tell you, I've told this story before and had people say, getting caught in an avalanche isn't a hero's act. It's not a, you know, cool thing to brag about. And I continue to tell people, I'm not at all bragging about this. Yeah. In fact, this was one of the worst, you know, backcountry decisions of my life.
Yeah.
But the beauty is I got a bonus round to be able to tell this story and hopefully have people listen to that when they're out there skiing.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely doesn't come out to me like you're bragging at all. And again, like you know, type two fun, type three, whatever, you know, we're talking, these are gnarly stories you tell at the bar. That's what I always say, you know, or, you know, your grandkids or stuff like that. But, my favorite part is always the part you take away from what happened to you, or the, what I always like to say, the new Mariah that I met in that experience. And that piece becomes addicting. You and I were talking about this before we hit record, is like, I become addicted to the newest version of myself that I'm going to meet. And I even sometime, and then that, you know, raises your pain tolerance to the crazy thing you're going to do next. But it sounds like you met a new version of yourself through this experience. And that is what people should take away from it and seek out if they encounter an unfortunate event, to seek out what they can learn about themselves from it.
Absolutely.
That's the piece to tell.
Yeah. When you hear about the really unfortunate things that happen to people, mm-hmm. you can take a look at that and say, you know, this is a victimhood that I will take on. Or you can say, I've learned something new from this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And yeah, there's, I will say there's almost an addiction to putting yourself into a bit of adversity to see what comes out of that. And I love your statement of, you know, I'm going to meet the new Mariah, the next level of Mariah.
Yeah, I completely agree. That is very addicting. And sometimes that can be good depending on how low you start of the adventure level. You know, if adventure to you is, you know, going to the next state over in a car, okay, by the time you start escalating, things might not get so bad. But if you start, you know, but if your starting level is, you know, some astronomical thing, well, then maybe we, you know, that addiction could start to get, you know, dangerous.
Uh-huh.
as you've experienced for sure. But yeah, so, I would love to hear your story, in detail about donating your kidney.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I always laugh when I think about, you know, when I was down there in that time, and just put yourself in my situation, your body heat has gone down, you know, you're terribly injured, and you're relying on other people to come save you, which those are tough things that I had to deal with, you know, along with the having someone come and save me. I did not like that piece of it. I like to be self-sufficient and be the one who does the going out to help people out.
Very humbling, sounds like.
Yep. So lying there in the snow, 8 o'clock at night, you've got the fire going, and you tell your best friend, if there's ever anything that you need, you let me know. And so 11 years later, Bill calls me up and says, hey, I'd like to ask for a favor.
Yeah.
And I said, sure, you know, you need a place to stay, a ride to the airport, you know, maybe a lasagna. you name it. What do you need? And he says, I need your kidney. And I'm going through kidney failure. And it's really hard. It's destroying my life. I'm on a 5-year wait list before I can get a kidney. And so all my family has gone in and gotten tested to see if they can be a match for me. My brother Mike made it all the way through to the final tests when they decided that no, they weren't, you know, that they couldn't take him. So I'd like to ask you. And it's funny because I'm sitting right where I am now when Bill called, and I can almost remember that call that he made, and he was desperate. You know, he knew that his life was not going to be the same, and his life was not going to go on if he didn't get a kidney. But I also knew that the answer was going to be yes. And he said to me, Jay, you don't need to let me know now. He goes, but I'm going to send you some information about what it takes to be a kidney donor and the health, you know, concerns with it and those type things. And so he sent me that, and he said, you know, if in a week or so you could let me know. So again, I knew that the answer was going to be yes, but I went ahead and did my due diligence and read up that the dangers for someone to be a kidney donor are incredibly low. Incredibly low. And all of the things that people believe to be an issue with donated kidney are myths from years ago that continue to be perpetuated. But I will tell you, there's one thing that I cannot do, and that is I'm not allowed to take ibuprofen. And some people are like, oh, that would be a no-brainer for me. But I haven't taken ibuprofen in 20 years, so it wasn't like that was a big deal for me. Right. So that's the one. And the reason for that is ibuprofen's really bad on your kidneys. And it, and a lot of times, causes kidney failure when you take too much ibuprofen over time.
Yep.
So, nonetheless, that was the big thing. Everything else, I can go on and do however I want to do. And then the next thing that will come up is people will say, well, if my kid ever needs a kidney, I want to be able to give them my kidney. But the truth is, because I donated, if my kids ever happen to need a kidney, they now are covered by the fact that I donated a kidney. So I now have this ability to get them a kidney. Oh, wow. And then the last thing is, what happens if I ever go into kidney failure? Mm-hmm. And that happens so rarely. But if it does, I go to the top of the list to get a kidney. Right. So those were the key risks. But yeah, when I told Bill that I was willing to go through with this, he was elated because he had been down in the dumps thinking that, you know, this was a death sentence to him. And so, gosh, I guess that was April that he called me. And in November 1st, I donated my kidney to him, and it took immediately. And he went from they rate your kidney as GFR or glomerular filtration rate. Most people have between a 60 and an 80 GFR. Bill's was down to 14. When I found out I was going to be a kidney donor, I looked up what are the top 10 kidney-friendly foods, and I started eating them in excess. and I bumped up my GFR to 137. So when I donated my left kidney to Bill, he immediately went to a GFR of 95. So the kidney, really just started doing the work that he hadn't had in a while.
What did you, I mean, I'm sure there's no one thing, but if you could find one thing, what was like the one thing you took from that experience?
Number one is I need to work on my friends to make sure I'm a good enough friend to my friends that they donate a kidney to me. No, and I will say the other thing that I really got from there was a connection that I had. I mean, Bill and I had always been great friends off doing crazy adventures together. But now this was that next crazy adventure.
Yeah, definitely. I can't even imagine where both of you were at that like pivotal moment, you know, a friend asking a friend and then a friend replying in the way you did. I think it's a pretty amazing experience that, I mean, I personally have never come across. I don't think that's an everyday kind of occurrence. I think it's probably something pretty magical that might not even be able to go into words.
Yeah. I will say the how the events of life transpired to make that happen were pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So I will say on a couple of things that this is something reflecting now 4 years post-donation, that most kidney donors run into this, and that is when they first donate, they're so thrilled and they're so invested in the outcome, and you know, they feel this certain sense of this was something that I was called to do and I did it. Mm-hmm. Whether they give to a friend, a family member, or a complete and total stranger. And in the first few months after that donation, people will say things like, you're a hero, you're exceptional, you're amazing in this way that you did it. Now, at 4 years looking back, I don't want people to say that.
Yeah.
And the reason that I don't is I don't think there's anything exceptional or amazing or heroic about what I did that other people cannot do. Yeah. So anyone can do it. There are currently 150 to 170 altruistic kidney donors that come forward to say, I want to give a kidney to anyone that needs it. That happens every year. But there's 100,000 people waiting for a kidney on the wait list.
Yeah.
So saying you're a hero or saying what you've done is heroic actually almost levels it to, well, and that's something that I could never do. But in reality, you can. And, you know, anyone can really do it. But the second thing is, when you do something like this, it's interesting because it's something that you want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But in my talking about it and putting it out on social media and, you know, having it be, you know, a dominating topic of conversation, I actually had two of my friends tell me, hey, man, it's kind of sounding like you're doing a little self-promotion here.
Mm-hmm.
And be careful with that. Which immediately made me go, oh, crap. You know, yes, this is part of my life, but I don't want this to be, you know, a self-promotional aspect of it. And so I actually backed off and quit posting things about it, quit talking about it. Mm-hmm. And it's a common thing that, you know, now that I spend time with numerous kidney donors, that everyone has experienced in one form or the other.
Obviously, I commend friends looking out for friends. Speaking about your friends who kind of pulled you aside. But I also feel like sometimes people ruin good things. Maybe how you would talk about it, maybe could, I've not read your post, so no, but, I also think it's just in the eye of the people reading it is you're either inspired, you're jealous, or you're just angry and you're angry at the world. So it wouldn't matter what you were posting. I hear a story like this, and if I were to read it multiple times on my feed, it would definitely inspire me and make me look at, maybe not, should I do something like this, but self-reflection of, you know, what is my version of this that I'm comfortable with that can help the world?
Yeah.
Because I think you're right with the hero conversation. I think that might just be people saying a word and not realizing what that word is. And I love that you're like, you know, hero kind of means that not many people can do it. But then you said something that triggered to me, you know, it's like, maybe they can't. That's what they're saying to you, is that I physically can't see myself doing something like this. Or I don't, you know, I don't want to.
Right.
So it is heroic.
And, you know, certainly that is, you know, everyone gets the choice of what they do with themselves, with their body, et cetera, et cetera. And there are a number of people who say, I would never go under the knife and do an elective surgery that doesn't benefit me. It only benefits somebody else, and it could hurt me. And I get that.
I think it would depend on who asked. You know, I think everybody, if you're fortunate enough to have connections in this world, you have a running list of friends, family, people who would ask for something, and you might pause for a second, or you might say, yes, you know, whatever you need, I'm willing, you know, to give it.
Yep.
Especially if that, what would you say? Lasagna. What did you want?
A ride to the airport.
Honestly, I would give a kidney before I would give someone a ride to the airport. That's a lot, especially because people fly at never a time that's convenient.
Right. The 4:30 ride to the airport is never fun. Never.
No,
fun.
No. Take my kidney. Honestly, don't please call it. Don't make me do that.
I have actually offered to just pay for a Uber or a shuttle service to take someone to the airport versus.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the new, like, someone must really love you.
Yeah.
in this day and age, because you can just Uber, you know, but if you're basically saying, I care enough about you to be the first person that you see, you know, when you come back, or the last person you see before you leave, or I want just one more hug, or I want the first hug, you know, something like that. That might be the ultimate version of I love you or I care about you is.
I think so.
Does he or she take me or pick me up from the airport? That's yeah. That's a love language. It's a, what are those? There were five right. love languages. I think there's a sixth.
Yeah. Right. Will you take someone to the airport?
Yeah. Honestly, not many people are meeting that threshold. So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. So I love that story. And, you know, am I correct or am I incorrect in that you ended up hiking or doing, you know, something pretty amazing with other kidney donors? So an adventure on top of an adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. So first off, you know, I quit talking about my kidney donation journey for a while, because they always say, you know, what is it? Vegans, CrossFitters, and kidney donors, right? You know, how do you know if they are? Don't worry, they'll tell you soon enough. And it will be all that they'll talk about. So I try and avoid, or was trying to avoid, the conversation as much as I could. But 2 years ago, Bobby McLaughlin, a kidney donor and president of the Kidney Donor Athletes at the time, called me up and said, hey, I'd like you to do this advocacy hike with us up Kilimanjaro. And we have 22 spots to fill on this, and they're all going to be kidney donors. And so
it's amazing.
I thought, you know, I really don't want to be out talking about this. But Bobby's statement to me was saying, Jay, I understand there's a certain amount of, you know, you're trying not to talk too much about it, that, you know, this is not something that you want to make part of your identity. However, you know, how much is your silence helping out the 100,000 people that are waiting on the wait list for a kidney donation?
Yep.
And I thought, you know what, Bobby, you're right. So I went out. And it was kind of funny, because I did a fundraising for this, but I told people, all I want is $5. I go, don't give me more than $5 for this fundraising, because I really don't want it for the funds. I want it for you to say, I see you.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what's important to you, and I want to support you. And for $5, I can do that easily. There's no excuse. Yep. That I couldn't. And so it was really great, because I ended up raising $7,000 for the thing at $5 a piece. And then a lot of people just couldn't do $5. They were like, I've got to put in 50. I've got to put in 100 or 200. And it's like, I don't want that, but thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're giving away my fundraising secret. Yeah. How did you know that? I always ask for a dollar.
Yeah.
But, oh, God, you're so smart.
So, but nonetheless,
this is the gig. Yeah. You just ask for a very small amount, and you get a lot of a little, and then sometimes people are compelled to give more. It's amazing.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So nonetheless, I went on this trip, and it was amazing. And an award-winning documentary was made of it, called The One Kidney Climb. And it was, you know, just an amazing trip, meeting 22 other kidney donors climbing to the top of the continent of Africa. And so that actually, we got on Good Morning America. They did a big piece on it. But it was really just this advocacy for telling people that you can donate a kidney and still do something pretty, you know, amazing with your life.
Yep.
So this gets, you know, picked up and heard, and there was a gentleman who had just done the 7 summits of the world in under a year, and he was the first living kidney donor to do it, named Dave Ashley. And Dave called me up and said, hey, I would like to try and set the Guinness World Record for the 50 high points of the United States. And the, you know, official you know, validated by Guinness was 43 days, set by Michael and Matt Moniz. And they, he said, I'd, you know, like to do this, and we're not going to do a fundraising. This is solely, we'll get some gear sponsors, and Alaska Airlines, did a sponsorship of the flights from Hawaii to Alaska and back. And NKR, the National Kidney Registry, sponsored this, and then all sorts of gear sponsors that that gave us gear. But we went out and did the 50 high points, which is the highest point in every state, and a captain from Alaska Airlines, Jody Harskamp, absolutely amazing woman, and just, you know, like rides the Iditarod on her fat tire bike in the middle of winter with negative 31 degrees. So hardcore. She joined in too and led us up to the top of Denali. And so her and Dave had done Denali, I hadn't, but we went up and did it in some ridiculous time frame. Yeah. And then we went on, and you know, the three of us hit a number of points along the way, and then there were some sections where there were safety concerns, and Jody basically was like, listen, I'm not going to give my life for this. And I'm like, yeah, me neither. But we continued. We did Granite Peak in Montana. We did Rainier in Washington. We did Hood in Oregon, and then, you know, on down. And then when I was at my peak of the type two fun, it was 13 nights of hiking straight through the night. Some of these were 27 to 26 hour missions where we were out in the snow, in the middle of the night, in winter storm warnings, just doing these climbs. And by the time I made it to Elbert, my home mountain, 30 minutes from my house, I lost it. So I may have been, and I probably would have been hypoglycemic, low blood sugar. I couldn't get enough food in me. I didn't get enough sleep. And I don't remember 2 hours of being on the mountain, in which I almost made it all the way down to the RV. And at the last minute, at 1 o'clock in the morning, I turned around and started hiking the mountain again and didn't recognize it until almost 3 o'clock in the morning when I went, wait a sec, where am I? So at that point, I realized enough danger. I had gotten to that point, that breaking point, where I realized, okay, I can still do this with a huge amount of danger and potential loss of life. Am I willing to do that? And the answer was, heck no. So I became part of the support crew, and I continued on. And Dave did continue, and he made all of the 50 state summits in 41 days.
Jeez.
And was just awarded with the Guinness World Record for doing that.
Well, I mean, we can talk right into it. You weren't willing to potentially die this time, but I have on my notes, and we talked before we hit record, that you've almost died seven, and you corrected me and said, I think actually it's three. to which I said, I mean, listen, if we're counting official versus nearly, you know, escaped. I mean, that's a story to tell. So I think it's pretty interesting that this was the line that you were like, maybe not this time I'm willing to die.
Yeah. My, You know, my mother has always been worried about this, and my father and his brothers actually had a pool going as to when I was going to die from, like, you know, 13 on. So, but somehow I managed to beat the record to where one of my uncles said, actually, the pool got big enough where we were thinking about taking out a hit on you. But
well, I would like to get in on that and say you're going to outlive us all. I'm 39 years old, and I am certain you will outlive me. Or if we, I don't know. Do you have 9 lives? I don't know.
Yeah.
So if it's 7, then you only have 2 more. Maybe that's what we have to discuss. Or technically, as you said,
right?
We died 3 times. Then yeah, I mean, we have a long.
There are near-death experiences, and then there's also the time when your heart stops and they have to bump you back or revive you. So, yeah, 7 were near-death, and 3 had to get bumped back to life. But
okay, so, I mean, we're going to have a part 2 to go through the many lives of Jay, which I'm totally down to have. But I have 2 questions. One, is there a time that stands out that you can tell us that story? And I mean, I'm not doing my job if I don't ask you, you know, what happens on the other side? Is there a bright light? What's happening? You got to let us in. Tell us the secret.
there's certainly a few times that, that stand out. The first one, I was, gosh, I guess I was 20 years old, and I was out skiing with my roommate from Alaska and her 2 crazy brothers. And we were skiing through the trees, and they were just so good and so fast. And I thought that I was that good and that fast, but I was not. And I managed to hit one of the trees.
I'm noticing a theme, Jay.
I know.
You stop skiing.
And I broke 4 ribs and collapsed my lung. But I did not know that. So I got back up and I skied down and chased them down the bump run. And they were loading the lift at that time heading up. So I said, I'm having a little tough time breathing, but I'll get back on the lift. So I got on the lift and I was following them up. And when I skied down to see them again with 4 broken ribs and a collapsed lung, I couldn't talk, but I was like, no, you know, what? And they called over ski patrol, which made me wait. And then I passed out a couple times. They got me into the sled, brought me down. Helicopter, Flight for Life came in, picked me up and brought me down. And at that point, they had to zap me back to life. And then they put a tube in my chest and got me breathing again.
I would like to start a petition for an intervention to be not skiing.
Yeah, I don't think I'm allowed to tell any of the ski stories anymore.
Yeah. Okay. So you said, is there another one that stands out? What's that? How about we go this? You said that one stands out. What's the most recent?
Yeah. That would be the one at Wolf Creek. Again, on skis with my friend Leslie and Ron, went up to the top of the Knife Edge Ridge, and I told him, I'm going to go down this way. I'm going to make a right, and I'll meet you in that open space down there. And 84 inches of snow had fallen in the last 3 days, and they had just opened it up. So I skied on down, and instead of making the right turn, I made the left turn, and I went off a cliff, and I landed head first, 6 feet under.
Jesus.
And Leslie skied down, and she did what I had told her to do and went out to the open space. And then she turns around and films Ron coming down. And Ron gets down. Now it's 4 minutes in. And she, in the frame, sees Ron up there. And he whips on down and he says, "Where's Jay?" And she goes, "Well, you know how he is. He might have skied on down to the bottom." And Ron looks up and goes, "That's his leg and his ski up about 200 vertical feet. And my leg was still moving with the ski in it. But they're 200 vertical feet below with 84 inches of snow. You cannot hike that very fast." as luck would have it, and they're yelling and calling for anyone to see what's going on. And as luck would have it, the person who probably had the highest desire to see me alive was the owner of Wolf Creek Ski Area, Davey Pitcher. And Davey just happened to ski by me, heard the yelling, saw my ski, and came over. And within 11 minutes of me lawn darting, he pulls my head, or digs and finds my head, and I'm purple, but I'm still breathing really slightly, and I have a faint pulse. And he pulls me around, ski patrol comes down, puts oxygen in me, bumps me back to life, and at the 26-minute mark, I wake up just as Leslie reaches me. And the first words out were, "Leslie!" Now, I will say Leslie hates this story because she was filming it and didn't notice me, but you can see in the film my leg moving, but there's so much going on and sunshine. I do not blame her at all. I also appreciate her for catching the film footage.
Leslie, we don't blame you if you're listening to this, and I'm going to need you to submit that video.
Absolutely.
Jay, you taught me many a thing in this almost hour we spent together. First one is you might have convinced me / inspired me to look into giving a kidney to a random stranger. And two, I'm never picking up a pair of skis or going on any mountain snow ever. I have hundreds of jumps jumping out of an airplane. And I would do that every day for the rest of my life, then go on one skiing trip, especially with you.
There are still people that ski with me, and it does shock me.
They need some talking to. I feel like there's no hope for you. I can't feel like I can get through to you. You're going to do what you need to do, which is fine. And we love you and we support you. And I would like to get in on the pool. But, you know, your friends, yeah, we should talk to them. we definitely should have some sort of intervention. Jay, we didn't get to even half of the things that I want to, so that I'm going to demand that you come back for a part two. But what I would love to leave the listeners with is, do you have, you know, a parting piece of overwhelming knowledge that you've learned so far on your life adventure that can all these type two fun listeners, people who absolutely love going out there and pushing the limits and, you know, being so unbelievably uncomfortable that they can't wait to do it again. What do you have to say to them?
You know, there's all sorts of things. One thing that when I started my business, I actually came up with the tagline of transforming lives through adventure. And I will say this all came about from working with a coach. And the coach said, you know, what would you like to do with the rest of your life? And I said, I want to put on these adventures and take people out to show how it can transform their lives. And he, you know, said, yes, you need the why of what you're doing, you know, to be part of that. And so first my statement is, you know, look for that why of why you're doing what you're doing. And sometimes you may be working in a job you hate, but the why is it gives you the financial ability to do the bigger things, right? Take care of your family, take care of your kids, and that's okay. Go ahead, keep doing that. Yeah. You know, every job doesn't have to have some incredible higher purpose.
Great.
But then the other thing, and you gave me this, and I absolutely love this statement, and that is pain demands to be felt.
Yep.
I will tell you that I have pushed down enough pain in my life at different areas. And I completely agree with your statement that it will manifest in other ways. And it has with me as well. So yep. For the listeners, when you go out there to do that type two fun, fully feel that pain, whatever that pain is, and feel free to let, whether it be romantic, emotional pain, whether it be physical pain, whether it be, you know, adversity of any sort, feel it.
Yeah.
And let it, you know, become part of you, but not own you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make your way out of that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I wrote a blog for what was a social media post that then Donovan Carey and I talked about and put into a blog, but it was basically the expression of that quote that I told you, pain demands to be felt, is also that there's healing power in doing hard things. And, you know, sometimes when you've got all this emotion and you don't know how to get it out, because that's the other thing is, yeah, okay, pain demands to be felt, and it's going to find a way to work through what it needs to, whether it manifests physically, mentally, you know, whatever. But you can even have the awareness that you need it out, but not know how to get it out.
Yep.
And, you know, and obviously there's talk therapy and even sometimes medical, you know, ways. But for me, a surefire way to bring out that beast and to work through those emotions is to go do something hard. And I'll send you the link, but I wrote a blog about it because I was going through some stuff after the pandemic. And I called Carrie and I was like, I need something hard. What is it? You know, immediately, you know, in under 30 days, you know, I gotta work through some shit. And she was like, Salkin Dai Pass in Peru. What do you think? And I was like, done.
Yep.
You know, and the top of the pass, we got there and I just bawled my eyes out and I was like, there it is. And I jumped, you know, I jollied back down the mountain, like, okay, now I'm fine. Everything's good, you know, completely new. I'm healed, you know, now let's have some fun. So, I completely agree. It's really, really good set of advice that you got there. And, like I said, also nobody ski with Jay. Okay. Ever. Unless it's somebody you don't like. No, I'm just kidding. I'll end up on Dateline one day.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, this was phenomenal. And I would like recording proof that you promised to come back and tell some more stories.
I absolutely promise.
Remember, it doesn't have to be fun to be fun. Thank you for joining us on the Type 2 Fun podcast. We will see you next time. But until then, explore our adventures at www.embarkexplorationco.com.